ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You might have been told that to get ahead in your career, you need to learn how to manage up. Now, what does it actually mean to manage up? And how can you do it in a way that's human and relational rather than transactional? Hello, welcome to This Working Life. I'm Lisa Leong, helping to make your work life better. On LinkedIn, I asked you to share your thoughts and tips on managing up, and we'll explore some of those ideas during the program as well. My expert guest for this topic works in the United States with large corporations and on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., but she's actually an Aussie from rural Victoria. Margie Worrell is a leadership advisor and author of The Courage Gap. Hi, Margie.
Hey, Lisa. Good to be with you.
So what does managing up actually mean to you, Margie?
It means influencing what those who are in more senior roles than you think and what they do.
In Australia, we're pretty squeamish about that word or the concept.
Yeah, I think that word managing, I mean, the word managing, I think probably triggers a little squeamishness, but I just kind of look at it as, how do you influence those people? You're not necessarily like hardcore managing them because you don't have power over them, right? So, yeah.
On LinkedIn, Renata says, managing up is often misunderstood for flattery. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think some people think flattery is what you do to manage up, to influence. You know, earn good favour and make them feel good about themselves. And of course, flattery could be part of it, but anything that's inauthentic and where people can just smell it a mile away, that you're there for yourself purely and you're just kind of, I mean, in Australia, I grew up with the term brown nosing, which isn't, I know, a little crude, but it's that, you know, no one likes one of those people. So I think when you talk about flattering, I kind of think of that too.
And why is managing up, or as you put it, influencing without authority, important?
Because our ability to be successful in any organization is going to be dependent on how well we can influence what other people think, what other people do. And those people aren't always people that we have positional power over. And so when it comes to managing up, how do you influence those people who, they mightn't even be your boss, by the way. It's not necessarily your boss. It could be, but it could be any person that, you know, has some level of authority or is in a position that people perceive as being more important than you, you know, in air quotes here. And how do you grow a relationship with them? How do you build trust with them? How do you have them think differently? You know, make maybe different decisions that are aligning with what you think is the best thing for, you know, your organization, whatever it is.
So you're talking here not even just your direct manager or boss, mm-hmm. but your boss's boss and even all the way.
Yeah, but it could be someone else in your organization that's like, you're working in the marketing department over here, right? And then over there in sales, you got the head of sales or you got the head of engineering or something. So it's not even necessarily in your direct function line, but you want to impact those people and you want to have them thinking and realizing, understanding things that maybe they're just oblivious to.
And as you're sharing, I'm thinking about soft diplomacy. That word sort of came to me. You do work with leaders in corporate America, but you've also trained congressional chiefs of staff in mm-hmm. Washington, D.C. So what do people in that environment, when it comes to influencing, need to know?
In either, it is about that relational aspect that you talked about. And I think of it as building trust, your currency of trust. What can people trust you for? And when it comes to, you know, yes, on Capitol Hill, obviously there is a lot of different factors and variables at play when it comes to getting people to do things. You're trying to form alliances. And of course, if you come back to the, like, what's in it for them? Like, why would it be good for them to do the thing that you'd like them to do and help and obviously communication, but helping people see what's in this for them that would have them, you know, vote the way you want them to vote, put money towards something, support whatever your cause is.
Margie, I put a post on LinkedIn and I asked people for their experience and thoughts on managing up. And this one came from John.
I would say be a solution provider, not a problem creator. Busy people have enough to do. You don't want to add to their list. I think this is where trust can play a massive role, especially when the environment might be challenging. If you're trusted by your manager, they're more likely to share critical information with you about something big that might be coming up that you can get to work on, and that can significantly increase your value to an organisation.
Thoughts, Margie?
Yeah, I mean, just trust is what I heard there. You know, if you can be trusted to get stuff done, that you help solve problems, you don't create more problems. And if you think of it in terms of, and he just used the language value, like how valued you are, what is the value that you bring? Are you someone that's good at solving problems, that can build alliances and relationships and networks outside your specific domain, that is a creative problem solver, that can get other people on board and going, okay, what are some creative ways we could tackle this that haven't been done before? One of the most crucial things John just said there was about being a solution provider. And a lot of people get very attached to their complaints and be very negative, and this is what's wrong, and I don't have enough of this, and I need more support, and this person's an idiot, and I need more resources. But are you someone that just gets stuff done, that makes things happen? And I think if you have a reputation as someone who can get stuff done, that can navigate through all of the power dynamics, that can navigate through all of the competing interests and competing priorities, that obviously exponentially grows your value. And you, as I've often said to people, you know, when you can solve small problems, you get rewarded by getting a promotion that gets you bigger problems. And then when you're really good at solving the bigger problems, you get rewarded again with another promotion to even bigger problems. But recognizing for anyone who's thinking, how do I manage up or how do I influence, just know that these people have a lot of problems, and some of them you're not even aware of. How do you help solve their problems? How do you make their lives easier? How do you help them move toward more of the outcomes they want and not be adding to their to-do list?
And I'm thinking of Capitol Hill, and I'm wondering, how do you build trust with someone who might have a different agenda to you, Margie?
Look for common ground. Obviously, in the United States, it's a very polarized environment. And there's people who are in the far corners of, you know, when it comes to political ideology and thinking. But often, if you zoom up high enough, you'll find some common ground. And, you know, we all want, you know, whether it is we all want our kids to have a better education, we all want a future where people, you know, have access to energy and power, et cetera. Now, different ideas about how to get there, but how do we find that common ground? And often there's a give and take and there's some compromise. But I think those who are really good at it build trust over time. They take care of relationships astutely. They're regularly checking in, and they're actually going out of their way to do favors for people, like, hey, here's some information. Hey, thought you'd like to know this. It sort of adds, it's like a coin in the currency account. And over time, you've got the more coins in that account, then the easier it is to be able to do a withdrawal and say, hey, could you do me a favor? So be thinking about that. And when I say favors, it's like sometimes that is just sharing information, bringing somebody in on something, that all helps to build up that goodwill, that bank of trust.
You're listening to This Working Life on ABC Radio National. I'm Lisa Leong. We're learning all about managing up with my guest, leadership advisor Margie Worrell. And in just a moment, you are going to get some practical tips and a very handy tool on how to best manage up. Now, Margie, I mentioned that I put up a post on LinkedIn asking people for their experiences and thoughts about managing up. I think you'll find this one interesting given what you just shared. Here's Sarah.
Managing up is a critical strategic leadership capability. It is a value exchange that you need to think bigger and more broadly about, and it is about building trust, credibility, and influence so that you have enough goodwill to make an ask when you get to that point.
Margie, thoughts?
Yeah, that is that currency account of trust. And you cannot influence well without trust. And Sarah just talked about, it's about building credibility. You know, credibility. Are you someone that knows what you're doing? But are you someone that people can count on to do the right thing, even when it might cost you? And when I think of trust, I kind of think of those core domains. It's not just about competence. It is about you having character and integrity, and people know they can count on you to show up consistently in the right way. And you build that over time. So if you're coming into a new team or a new business or a new organization and you're trying to like manage up, you don't have a lot in the account. So it takes time to build that. And of course, we know when it comes to trust, it can take a long time to build and it takes a second to have it just blow up. So being really meticulous in making sure you're showing up with integrity, with character. And of course, you know, we see lots of examples where people don't do that. It really undermines their ability to influence others across an organization and up over time.
Does it always need to be an ask in the back of your mind?
You can frame this as an ask. It may be that you're wanting them to think differently about how to go about a problem, how to execute on a strategy. So maybe there's a specific ask. I don't think it's always involving an ask. It may be just about how they're approaching something. But yeah, you could boil all this down to a specific ask. Can you do this differently? And I do think it's important to always be specific when you're making a request. Exactly what is it that you want? Exactly when do you want it? And make it easy for them to say yes. I think if you're going in with a really big ask, you're going to reduce the chances of getting the yes you want, unless, you know, you've got a heck of a lot of trust in that account. But how can you go to your manager? How can you go to someone who is in a more senior position to make it so easy for them to say yes? It's such a no-brainer, but you've got to be able to make your case for that. Hey, here's information. I'm not sure if you're aware of this. You know, I've got this and I've got this. It kind of bolsters your case that they can see that it's very low risk for them to do that. You're making them look better too. And something I want to just add here is if you think about a lot of people who are in senior roles, we'd like to think that they were all really secure people that weren't threatened at all, that had absolute confidence in the value that they bring and how much they're valued. But that's just not the case. Most people who are in senior roles, they've got their own little insecurities. They've got their own fears and concerns about their role and their future. And we often fail to recognize that if we're coming across in a way that they feel threatened, that they might lose something, that they're going to lose face, they're going to lose reputation, that people might think that they don't know what they're doing, that's not going to help you. So always be mindful of what could be their unspoken concerns, insecurities, fears, and make sure that whenever you're going in with an ask or anything else that you're speaking into that.
Okay, before we leave Capitol Hill then, do you have any stories or examples that can bring some of this theory to life for us, Margie?
Well, the work I do on Capitol Hill is actually very much Chatham House rules. So I cannot share specific examples of this person or that person. So all I will say is that what you don't see in the media is that a lot of these congressional chiefs from both sides of the aisle are actually often on better terms with each other than you might see in the media. I mean, we see a lot of the uglier side, but often, this including elected officials, often those people, and I'm not talking all of them, they're often quite friendly and cordial with each other when the cameras aren't rolling. So, you know, this is part of the game of politics, right? And they've got to be seen to be super combative, et cetera. But the congressional chiefs are often actually doing a lot of work behind the scenes, you know, moving things forward in ways that you never see.
How much is there compromise then?
That's a really big one when you think about, you know, how much do I sell out on what I hold to be true? And I think that's why you've got to zoom up and up and up and go, okay, I might want to have, you know, $1 billion put towards renewable energy or sustainability infrastructure or something like that because I'm super passionate about environment, but that's not going to go through. So there's got to be give and take. There's always got to be that give and take. It's like, well, it's better to get something through than nothing through. And while this is obviously extremely relevant in a political context, it's also relevant in organizations too. It's like, what's the common ground and being willing to compromise and thinking about it through the lens of the other person goes, well, what is it that they really value here that we can help us move forward? Because it's got to have something in it for everybody.
And is there anything else that we should be aware of when we're sort of translating what you've shared in the political environment to the corporate world?
Well, I think one thing is true is culture matters a lot. And when there's a toxic culture and a culture of fear, that's obviously going to shut down a lot of important conversations. We obviously see a lot of fear in the US, in the political realm right now. In corporates, in organizations, there's often far higher standards when it comes to, or aspirations when it comes to culture. And whenever there is a lot of psychological safety, which we know is the number one predictor of high-performing teams, it makes it easier for people to speak openly, to say, hey, this is what I think, to disagree, engage in what I call loyal dissent. We're all loyal to the same ultimate mission, but we can disagree with each other and have those debates. So I think culture is always going to be a really important factor when it comes to managing up, influencing across for any group of people to be able to get stuff done.
All right, Margie, let's get practical now. What are some strategies that you recommend to your clients for managing up?
Well, firstly, just start with putting yourself in their shoes and thinking through what is it that's going on for them? What is it that they want? Not only what do they want, their goals, but what are their fears? Because often we don't think about that and we're not approaching them with enough, I say empathy, but thinking about, you know, how is it that they're feeling? Not just what they're thinking, but how are they feeling here? And keeping that in mind as you put together whatever it is you want to influence them, as you approach them. Make it easy for them to say yes. Help them see what's in it for them so that this is a no-brainer. And small little yeses add up to big things over time. Third, think about how can you be showing up as someone that they know when you're approaching them, you're there for the same ultimate purpose as them. Like, make sure they know you're on the same team, that this is in service of a better outcome for your team or your division or your company. Because if it can be perceived as like, oh, this is just in it for you, so be really explicit with that. Here's how I think we can add more value for customers. Here's how I think we can be more efficient in our production processes. Make sure that they can see why this is ultimately not just good for you or good for them, but actually good for the organization. And give them language that they can maybe use with their higher-ups, because they've often got to be selling things too. They're also in the business of managing up and influencing too.
And Margie, can you talk us through your stakeholder mapping exercise?
Whenever I work with a client, I always say, okay, let's just do a stakeholder map. Who are up, across, down? It could be customers, it could be board, it could be, you know, in the US, the Wall Street, you know, what are the analysts saying, et cetera. So thinking about all those people and going, okay, you know, what is it I need to be communicating to them? You know, how should I be touching base with them? What's the cadence of all of that? Certainly, if you don't have the positional authority you'd like, building alliances, strengthening those relationships, you know, you can then want to make those withdrawals over time. So continually being very, I think, vigilant about that. How can I be making sure people that at some point in time I may want to, you know, reach out to and influence, that they're thinking well of me, that there's a lot of goodwill there and a lot of that currency of trust.
Do you actually write it out?
Yeah, I think it's really helpful. I mean, if there's a whiteboard in a room, I mean, if there's not a whiteboard, I mean, with a piece of paper, sometimes I'll ask someone, so like, I want you to go away and do this and then let's talk about this and map that out. The research shows when you put pen to paper, when you have something that's visual, I mean, maybe you're doing it on your laptop, it actually just helps your brain to connect dots you mightn't otherwise.
And with each person, do you have key attributes or things that you would write or look for fill out?
Yeah. What are the number one things that they want? Also, what are the number one things that they'll be afraid of? Like, what is it that could be keeping them awake at night? And emotions drive behavior, not logic. That's why we can often think very easily of smart people who do dumb things, because they're driven more by emotions. So thinking about what are the emotions that they're feeling and what's that fear factor? Fear is a very powerful driving force. And so being able to, even when you're putting something to them, what do you know that they're really afraid might happen? And how can you present your solution or what you're suggesting in a way that helps de-risk that?
You work a lot with fear and then courage. So what are your tips with the role that courage plays when we're talking about managing up and people?
Well, people are often afraid to have those conversations and reach out. I can think myself earlier in my career when there was opportunities to manage up and I was afraid of an awkward conversation. I was afraid of someone thinking, who do you think you are? I was afraid of rejection. And I see that play out all the time. I see so many people who are feeling resentful, frustrated, stuck, stressed. And I'll say, have you had a conversation about that? Have you approached someone about that? Have you shared that? And they're like, well, no, you can't just go and do that. I'm like, who says you can't? So I think it's really important to just recognize where our own fear keeps us from having the very conversations with people, often those in more authority, that actually could open the door, could improve things. Lisa, early in my career, I worked in a role that I was told would be involve a whole lot of really interesting things to do. I got in there, I was in my 20s, and the manager was very checked out. There was a pretty toxic team environment. And I realized pretty quickly, oh, this isn't the bill of, you know, goods that I was sold in terms of what the role would be. And instead of talking to anyone about it, I just grew more and more disengaged. I withdrew. And finally, after a year, I decided to leave. And I handed in my resignation. And the guy who was the divisional director asked to see me. He said, Margie, you know, I'd really hoped you'd have a career here. You know, I'm so sorry you're leaving. You know, can I understand why? And at that point, I was like, what the heck? I might as well just be truthful. And I said, well, you know, I wasn't given any support. You know, it was a pretty nasty work environment. I was told I'd be doing this. I was given very little direction. And he said, you know, if you'd come to talk to me about that, maybe I could have done something. And to me, that experience showed the power of just being willing to brave the difficult conversation and share with someone, this is what's going on for me and this is what I'd love for me to enjoy, you know, working here and being able to bring the value that I'd like to bring. But I think for people overall, we've got to always be just mindful of, you know, where is my own fear keeping me from having the conversations that would influence upward, that would open up new doors of opportunity, that would help me have more value, because no one goes to work not wanting to do a good job. You have to be your own advocate. You have to be your own advocate. And that means sometimes risking someone not responding well, but you risk it because you're committed to your own growth and to adding more value. And that's just a risk that we have to take if we want to flourish in our careers.
All right, which brings us to try this. So each week, we ask our guests to share some sort of advice, specific thing to try to make their work lives better. What do you want this working lifers to try this week?
Brave the awkward conversation. Have the very conversation that a fearful little part of you doesn't want to have, because it doesn't want to feel rejected. It doesn't want someone to react badly. And just step in and have it. Get really clear about why you're having it. Get anchored in why this is ultimately not just great for you, but it's why it's actually good for everybody. And brave that awkward moment. Because most of the time when we have those conversations, we go, huh, wasn't as bad as I thought. And two, should have had it sooner. And we often suffer way more from what I call anticipatory stress, thinking about how stressful it will be, than from just doing the very thing, from having it. So brave the awkward.
All right. This week, I want you to brave the awkward and then report back. So you can report back at thisworkinglife@abc.net.au, or you could write on our post in LinkedIn as well. Margie Worrell, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lisa.
Margie Worrell there, a leadership advisor and the author of The Courage Gap. And before we finish up, I want to go back to last week's episode about passion at work. We spoke to passion at work expert researcher Jon Yahimovich, and it's called Is Your Dream Job Still Dreamy? And you can find it on the ABC Listen app. I asked you to respond to this phrase: if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. Dara wrote to us this week with her response to that.
Unless your passion somehow magically brings in money with you never having to do anything operational or strategic or anything to do with, you know, the actual fundamentals of running a business, then inevitably you're still working. But I think when you're doing something that you're super passionate about, that side of the job slash work feels less grueling because your cup is so full from the actual delivery or giving back or purpose behind what you're doing.
Thanks, Dara. And thank you for listening to This Working Life with me, Lisa Leong. If you haven't already, search for This Working Life on the ABC Listen app and tap the heart to follow all of our stories. This episode was produced by Michelle Weeks, engineered by Tim Simons. We're on the lands of the Wurundjeri people in Naarm, Melbourne. Until next time, work it, baby.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hey, I'm Sana Qadar, host of All in the Mind on ABC Radio National, and I have a question for you. Have you ever wondered what is going on inside someone else's head? I think about this a lot because on All in the Mind, we cover psychology and mental health and why people behave the way they do.
How do other people make this decision?
Maybe it's sending a signal to someone about the reliability of someone.
How can this possibly be?
So if you like the sound of that, check out All in the Mind on the ABC Listen app.